Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good morning, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker. It's a real pleasure to welcome one of the longest-serving members of the House of Representatives to the Commonwealth Club of California. Steny Hoyer of Maryland has served 16 terms in the House, beginning in 1981 at the age of 41. Congressman Hoyer is a strong advocate of the Democratic Party's policies to strengthen America's middle class, its economy, and its national security. As House Democratic Whip for the 112th Congress, Steny Hoyer is the second-ranking member of the House Democratic leadership. He is charged with mobilizing the party vote on important legislation, acting as a liaison between members and the Democratic leadership, and coordinating strategy within the caucus. He also plays a key role in shaping House Democrats' legislative priorities and in delivering the party's message. Congressman Hoyer previously served as House Majority Leader from 2007 to 2011 and as the House Whip from 2003 to 2007. In our recent recession, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, Congressman Hoyer helped lead House passage of investments and tax cuts that nonpartisan experts say are responsible for the creation of 3 million jobs. He made crucial contributions to the passage of legislation to expand access to affordable health care to all Americans, as well as new common sense rules to rein in Wall Street excesses and protect consumers, while all along upholding the principles of the free market. Steny Hoyer believes that fiscal responsibility is critical to ensuring that we have the resources to protect important programs such as Social Security and Medicare. And to that end, he helped lead the restoration of the pay-as-you-go law, ensuring that our country can pay for what it buys. He has been an advocate for those who have been hit hardest by the economic crisis and has fought to help people who have lost jobs through no fault of their own. And he's been a strong advocate to encourage small businesses to grow and to create jobs. He has been critical of his Republican colleagues by claiming that job creation has not always been a priority for them. He's been very vocal about bringing jobs back home from overseas by promoting the Make It in America agenda. Congressman Hoyer is strongly committed to public education, and he believes that we must get our fiscal house in order so we can invest heavily in schools. And this includes support for full-service community schools, whose range of services has been shown to improve academic performance and parental involvement in at-risk communities. As an advocate of equal opportunity, Congressman Hoyer guided the historic Americans with Disabilities Act to passage in 1990, as well as the ADA Amendments Act in 2008. He was a lead sponsor of the Help America Vote Act in 2002, which was hailed as the most important voting rights legislation since the 1960s. And in 2010, he was a leader in successfully ending the policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He is a respected voice on defense and foreign policy and has worked on the passage of the annual Homeland Security, Intelligence, and Defense Authorization bills, which are critical to our national security. Steny Hoyer is a moderate voice for compromise and is quick to create coalitions on both sides of the aisle. The congressman will be pleased to answer your questions after his prepared remarks, so I encourage you to come up with some tough and challenging ones. So let's give a warm welcome to the House Whip, Congressman Steny Hoyer.
Well, thank you very much. You know, when I hear that, I'd be pleased to answer your tough questions. I sort of grimace, and if they're not too tough, I'm sure I'll be pleased. If they're really tough, I'm not sure how pleased I'll be. But I am so pleased to be here with the Commonwealth Club. What an extraordinary history the Commonwealth Club has, and I've looked at some of your former speakers, and it's humbling to think that one would be at the same forum that so many extraordinary leaders of our country on both sides of the aisle have had the opportunity to speak to such well-informed leaders of this community. I want to tell you a little story, Joe, if I can, as I start out. First of all, last night in my hotel, I stayed at the Hilton. I came into my hotel and I had a little bag on my table as I came in, and I opened it up, and it was from a young woman with whom I served in a U.S. senator's office in 1964. I worked my way through law school working for a United States Senator, Daniel Brewster, from the state of Maryland. And one summer, the summer of 1964, there was a young intern who came to work in that office as well, and we sat about 10 feet from one another. I have sort of a little cubicle in the back, and she was sitting, this beautiful, bright, intelligent young woman was sitting for the summer as a receptionist. And so we got to know one another very well. And if you fast forward to the December of 2006, that young woman and I were elected Speaker and Majority Leader of the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi, as all of you know, is from Maryland. I know you claim her in California, and she is a Californian, of course, but she was born and bred in Baltimore, the daughter of a mayor and a member of Congress, and the sister of another mayor of Baltimore. In any event, that box of chocolates, of course, was from that young woman, Nancy Pelosi, welcoming me to your fair city. So I want to say how pleased I am to be here. I know that you are rightfully very proud of the leadership of the person we still call the Speaker, but she is the minority leader of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Joe, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. Thank you for getting us started here. Jack, thank you very much as well. You're the moderator. I see you're going through the questions. Be gentle. I understand Dr. Bitterman, your chair, and Ms. Casto, your vice chair, as well as your president, CEO, Dr. Duffy, are not here. But I am pleased to be here with all of you. For the purposes of discussing an agenda to which Joe referred, but which I believe is an extraordinarily important one for America, both in the short term and in the long term. I want to thank you for inviting me to the nation's oldest public affairs forum, a place that has hosted national leaders and visionaries like Teddy Roosevelt and Martin Luther King, Jr. It's an honor. It's an honor to speak where they spoke, and I want you to use this opportunity to talk about what I believe is one of the most pressing challenges to the future of America's middle class and to the future of America's leadership in the world economy. There have been numerous stories just over the last few days that you've read, I think, in the New York Times or the Washington Post or perhaps the Chronicle, outlining the growing extraordinary disparity between what working Americans are making and what people at the very top levels of the corporate community and private sector are making. The question is, will we or will we not keep pace with our competitors? Will we or will we not continue to lead the world economy? Will we be a country of world-leading innovation and a strong middle class? Will we continue to be a country that makes things, a country that leads the world in manufacturing and industry? We can and must remain that country. And that's why I want to talk about my highest priority as a leader of Congress. Let me parenthetically say, in my view, the biggest challenge confronting America is confronting the debt and deficit that we have accumulated. It is clear that we will not grow our economy. We will not be the kind of economy that we want to be. We will not be the kind of country that we aspire to be and have been if we do not get a handle on our deficit and debt. But what I want to talk to you about is, in effect, a subset, a very important agenda, which I call the Make It in America agenda, a plan to rebuild America's manufacturing strength. Manufacturing, as I will argue, has an overwhelming economic importance. But it's more than that. In America, making things is also a question of pride. And in order to rebuild our manufacturing ability, it's important to appeal to that pride. to the sense that manufacturing and middle-class opportunity it brings are part of the American character, and that we cannot and must not give it up. Making it in America. We had a discussion about what Americans thought we needed to do as we move forward. One of their responses overwhelmingly was that we had to have goods that were made in America. My response to that suggestion was, what we ought to call that agenda is not made in America. That's what we did yesterday. We ought to call it make it in America, because that's what we do today and tomorrow. And in effect as well, make it has two meanings. Make it is what every young person does when they high five and they won the game. We made it. It's what every young person says when they're going to take a test or try to get a job or play a game. We're going to make it. We're going to win. We're going to succeed. We're going to seize the opportunity. We're going to make it. We know that psychologically America is down as a society. They're not sure we're on the right track. They're not sure their lives are going to be better. They're not sure that their children's lives are going to be as good as their lives were. There's cause for that concern, but if that psychology continues, it will erode the very fabric, the very essence of why we have, in fact, made it in America. Because we had that spirit, that can-do spirit, that spirit of the little engine who thought he could. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. And they got up, that little engine got to the top of the mountain, and as he was going down, he said, I knew I could, I knew I could, I knew I could. You've all read that story, and you all love it, because it is the psychology of success. I think I can, to make it. In addition, make it means we're going to make it in America. We're going to manufacture it, we're going to grow it, and we're going to sell it here and around the world. Democrats' Make It in America agenda is founded on this basic belief. When we make more products in America, more families will be able to make it in America. I understand that fact may seem like our most pressing problem if you don't work in manufacturing yourself. But there are at least three reasons why every American ought to be concerned about manufacturing's decline. Competitiveness, the middle class, and innovation. Competitiveness, the middle class, and innovation. First, making it in America matters because competitiveness matters. Every American understands the importance of maintaining our leadership in the world's economy. I believe, like President Obama, in out-innovating, out-educating, and out-building our competitors, especially because countries like Germany and China are investing in their growth just when so many in America want to cut back on our own investments. As Bruce Stokes recently wrote in the National Journal, and I quote, export of goods account for 3/5 of all U.S. sales abroad, paying the bills for imports of consumer products and oil. However, he continues, the nation's share of the world's manufacturing trade has been shrinking. Now, America still leads the world in the total volume of manufactured goods produced. However, according to estimates recently published by IHS Global Insight, last year, China surpassed America in total dollar value of manufacturing output. And when our manufacturing falls behind, the rest of the economy suffers disproportionately. Sales of manufactured products stimulate more activity across our entire economy than the output of any other sector. Secondly, making it in America is crucial to the future of the middle class. The decline in manufacturing employment and the decline of our middle class have been closely linked. And both declines were dramatically accelerated under the Bush administration. From February 2001 to February 2009, nearly one-third of manufacturing jobs in America disappeared. We went from about 19 to 20 million manufacturing jobs, now down to a little over 11 million manufacturing jobs. What kind of jobs were they? Unfortunately, they were especially well-paying and attractive to middle-class families. While average total compensation across the spectrum is about $63,000 across all jobs. Manufacturing workers receive an average of nearly $75,000, or 16% more than non-manufacturing jobs. And what happened to the middle class during the Bush years? Median household income fell even as the economy as a whole expanded. The first time in our history that has happened. Of course, in December of 2007, we began a substantial contraction of our economy. When we talk about a, quote, lost decade for the middle class, we are talking to a great extent about a lost decade for manufacturing employment. And it should concern us greatly that during that same lost decade for the middle class, the top one-tenth of a percent of earners in America received more than 10% of all the personal income in America, largely, as I said at the outset, thanks to skyrocketing pay for executives. Third and finally, making it in America is crucial to the future of America innovation. Some claim that we've moved past manufacturing. They argue that America can remain an innovation leader while America invented goods roll off of assembly lines overseas. But frankly, we've been trying that model for a long time now, and it's failing us. I understand, of course, you understand very well in this area, that Silicon Valley is still the world's leading hotbed of innovation. But what many people miss is how closely that innovation is tied to our ability to produce goods in this country. Take the example of Amazon's Kindle, 2e reader. It originally retailed for about $350, approximately $185 of which went to manufacturing costs. As Harvard business professor Wally Shea has observed, the Kindle may have been designed in California. But of those $185 in manufacturing costs that went into every unit, only $40 plus went into every unit for manufacturing added in the United States, which is to say about 25% of the value added. The rest of the manufacturing value was taken to scale overseas. Shea writes and adds, missing out on manufacturing, the Kindle's advanced screen means that, and I quote, the U.S. will miss out on the future industries that spring from it. Things like large flexible displays, future generation of electronic signage and plastic electronics. This same story, he says, has played out in high-tech industry after high-tech industry. Those industries included everything from computer chips to precision optics to photovoltaics. All industries that America used to lead and all industries in which we have lost our lead as production moved overseas. Another example is the production of the advanced batteries that will soon power electric vehicles. Here's how Andy Grove of Intel explained it, and I quote, the U.S. lost its lead in batteries 30 years ago when it stopped making consumer electronic devices. U.S. companies didn't participate in the first phase and consequently, according to Andy Grove, weren't in the running for all that followed up. I doubt, said Andy Grove, that they will ever catch up. If he's right, and we fail to catch up, we'll lose out on well-paying jobs and untold economic growth, as well as an opportunity to strengthen our energy independence. When we failed to manufacturing growth concluded, and again I quote, we broke the chain of experience that is so important in technological evolution. When manufacturing migrates overseas, innovation follows it. America has fallen behind Japan in patent applications, and we're on a pace to be surpassed by China. As well, and again, one of the causes of failure is the failure to make it in America. Andy Grove's entire premise is that we are currently the center in the world of invention, innovation, and development of new products. However, we are increasingly taking those products to scale overseas, someplace else. Andy Grove's premise, I believe, is correct, that if we continue to do that, the inventors, innovators, and developers will follow the product overseas to where it's being taken to scale. Even in the best scenario, in which we're somehow able to stay an innovation leader without being a production leader, we face a future of widening inequality, a steadily growing gap between the creative class and the service sector, with fewer middle-class jobs to fill in that gap. That's not what I want for my country, for my three grandchildren, or for my two great-grandchildren. That's why I believe so strongly in the Make It in America agenda. That's why I want Congress to do everything it can to create the conditions for businesses to stay here, make profits here, innovate here, grow here, create jobs here, build products here, grow food and fiber here, and sell them here and around the world. That's why this agenda gets strong support from every audience I've spoken to. Red state, blue state, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, and everybody in between. One of the reasons I like this agenda so much is because it is an agenda that brings America together, does not drive it apart. There is not an audience I speak to in any place in this country, no matter how conservative they may be or how liberal they may be, when you suggest that we need to focus on making it in America, that does not shake their head and say yes. To that extent, it's an agenda that brings us together. That's why labor leaders, business leaders alike, understand its importance. Even though American manufacturing has struggled in many ways, there's still good news we can build on. We've seen success stories about manufacturers bringing jobs back to America. Ford is bringing 2,000 workers back to the U.S. from Japan, Mexico, and India. Ford is also planning on adding another 7,000 jobs here in the United States. I am proud of the fact of the actions taken by George Bush, Barack Obama, and the Democratic Congress to save the automobile companies in America. Ford, as you know, received no money. It didn't need it. But Mullally, the president and CEO of Ford, was one of the strongest supporters of making sure that Chrysler and GM survived. Why? Because if they'd gone out of business, the supply structure would not have been able to survive with only Ford. So the fact of the matter is, we also served our national security interest by retaining the largest manufacturing enterprises we have in America that are in America. We are now building jobs, and our cars are competing well. Another encouraging example, by the way, is Bavarian Motor Works. Bavarian Motor Works builds all of its SUVs in the United States of America and sells them where? In America, in Berlin, in London, in Paris, in Rome, in Tokyo. If Bavarian Motor Works can come to the United States of America and build its SUVs here and then ship them around the world and make a profit, certainly American manufacturers can do the same. The Make It in America agenda is about enabling more of those success stories. President Obama has already signed 6 Make It in America bills into law, bills that speed up the patent process for American inventors. And by the way, we just adopted in a bipartisan vote patent legislation reform last week in the Congress. Support our growing energy sector. Create tax cuts and loans for small businesses. Support science, technology, engineering, and math education. The STEM disciplines are extraordinarily important to us, which is why the president's correct. We need to not only invest in growing manufacturing, but we need to grow our educational capabilities as well. Many of those bills that passed won bipartisan support. This spring, we announced a new Make It in America agenda for this 112th Congress. One new bill would expand and make permanent the research and development tax credit. Clearly, one of the problems we have is that the research and development credit is sporadic, annually reauthorized, not able to be counted on necessarily. That is not true and most of our competitors around the world. That permanent R&D credit would create a stronger incentive for thousands of American companies to invest in new technologies. Making the R&D credit permanent, extending the R&D tax credit, will also help us reclaim our world leadership in innovation. In fact, the OECD recently found that the United States ranked a disappointing 24th out of 38 industrialized and developing countries offering R&D incentives. I think Congress has a responsibility to do better. I also introduced a new Make It in America bill, the Jobs Act, to build job training partnerships between advanced manufacturing businesses, community colleges, and work investment boards. Those partnerships will help American businesses grow by helping their workers find their way to the most promising fields. Jobs bill, by the way, means job opportunities between our shores. We thought that was relatively clever and spent some time coming up with that. You know, it's a very important part of our business. But jobs, opportunities between our shores is what Make It in America is all about. They'll help Americans find the job opportunities where the skills are most needed. Advanced manufacturing businesses have already been some of the most successful participants in federal job training partnerships, and the new legislation I'm introducing will build on that success. When more American workers have 21st century skills, businesses are able to grow by staying here. And when we build links between workers, manufacturers, and educators, we build what the National Journal calls an industrial ecosystem. A local network of company and resources to help one another survive. Another part of the Make It in America agenda is a more efficient corporate tax code, one that can promote growth and job creation by helping businesses make more decisions based on economic common sense rather than on maximizing tax write-offs. The commission, headed by Mr. Bowles and Senator Simpson, recommended the elimination of all preference items. I've talked to many, many corporate CEOs about this so that we would not be making decisions either in our personal lives or in our corporate lives based upon tax consequences as opposed to based upon positive consequences for our businesses and for ourselves and our families. A corporate tax code with lower rates and fewer loopholes is one more way to unleash economic productivity. Now, I'm proud to be a Democrat, and I'm sure that comes as no surprise to you. But I also recognize there is nothing partisan about this agenda. That is its beauty, in my view, and it is its importance. There's nothing partisan about out-innovating, out-educating, out-building our competitors. Rebuilding our manufacturing strength hits a deep chord with so many people I've talked to all across the country, because we take pride in making things, and we're worried that we might lose that tradition. Because we take pride in our culture of opportunity, and we're worried it won't be there for our children as it was for us. The Make It in America agenda is part of the solution. It's a solution to the joblessness and the displacement that we see in communities across our country. But it's also an attempt to take the defining challenges that with our country long before the recession and threaten to stay with us long after. If we fail to keep up with our competitors, then we won't simply see the consequences of the news or on lists of international rankings. We'll see the consequences in every community in America, in vanished jobs, narrower opportunity, and shrinking futures. But with wise choices today, we can avoid that. The best days of American industry and America innovation cannot be and must not be behind us. Wise investments, strong partnerships between business and government, and our tradition of making things all helped build the world's strongest middle class and strongest economy. I believe that the two are directly related. As we seek to rebuild and strengthen the middle class, we must turn to that tradition again. I believe that the values that created America's middle class, the energy, the hopefulness, the drive to compete and win that built our country, and more are more than things of the past. Those values are our inheritance, and they must also be the legacy we leave our children and our country. Millions of people have come to America believing that it was the land of opportunity and of success. It has been so for them and millions more. We as a people must have a conviction that we have the talent to do even better in the century that lies ahead. We must expect of one another the work ethic, the sense of shared responsibility, the willingness to take risks, the commitment to personal, corporate, and government fiscal prudence that will ensure our continued competitive advantage. Great societies fail all too often because they lose their edge. They retreat from the rigor that made them champions. They come to believe that God has ordained their success rather than rewarded their effort. Ulysses, in Lord Tennyson's exhortation to continued achievement, called upon his fellow citizens who had already achieved so much to continue to compete, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. If we do that, we'll make it in America. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to U.S. Congressman and Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer.
There are a lot of questions.
I'm Jack Cordes, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your moderator for today's audience question period. We have a number of questions, so let's begin. Congressman, there are many questions, as you might have suspected, around the debt and the budget discussions. So let's start there. This consolidates a lot of the questions that we've had. What is the Democrats' plan to deal with the budget crisis and the national debt? What programs should we prioritize in terms of funding and why?
The Democrats, when we were elected in 06 and took over the leadership in the Congress in 07, one of the first things we did was to pursue the adoption in our rules and ultimately statutorily. A provision which was called statutory paygo. It simply meant that we would pay for what we bought and not pass the debt along to future generations to pay for what we were using in this generation. I think that was the intellectually correct position to take. I also think it was the morally correct position to take. We have been pursuing, in my view, not only an intellectually bankrupt fiscal policy, but an immoral fiscal policy, which has heaped extraordinary debt on my children, of whom I had three, you heard a little earlier, my grandchildren, of whom I have three, and my two great-grandchildren, one of whom is 5 weeks of age. The debt that my generation is heaping on that little boy's head is an immoral debt. My father's generation was called by Tom Brokaw the greatest generation. I lament the fact that my generation may be called the greediest, most irresponsible generation. As a result, we must address this extraordinary debt and deficit that confronts us. Now, I was one, a Democrat, who at George Bush and Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke's instance voted for TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. It was Mr. Bernanke's premise that if we didn't, we would go into a depression, not a recession, a depression. I concluded that he was, on balance, more right than wrong, so I voted for TARP. We passed that, but we incurred $700 billion, and net probably it's about $450 billion. Then President Obama was elected. Every economist, including economist who had advised John McCain, Marty Feldstein, who advised Ronald Reagan, all indicated that we needed a stimulus package. We passed a stimulus package of $787 billion. I believe that that has worked. It has not worked nearly as well as we had hoped. When I say it's worked, we've created over 2 million jobs over the last 20 months. That's progress, but not success. when you lose 8 million and you only replace it with 2 million, there are 6 million people who are looking for but cannot find jobs. What to do, which is the question. We tried to have a statutory commission created by the Congress of the United States. We did not succeed. The president, therefore, appointed a commission known as Simpson-Bowles, headed by Senator Alan Simpson, former senator from Wyoming, and Erskine Bowles, former chief of staff at the White House and chair of the University of North Carolina University System. They came up with a plan, and their plan said what I think we have to do. That does not mean I believe that everything in their proposal we should do, but what they said is everything has to be on the table. There are four main areas that need to be on the table. Discretionary spending, which everybody focuses on, which is frankly 12% of the budget. That's non-defense, non-security discretionary spending. Then about 18% is security spending, but discretionary. That is, we make a determination every year to spend money on this object. That's two items. Both of them need to be on the table. Defense spending has not been on the table and needs to be. Then what needs to be on the table are entitlements. Entitlements are the toughest to deal with politically, but they're also the largest expenditure. And you cannot get from where we are to where we need to be in terms of bringing our debt and deficit down without dealing with entitlements. I believe that we can deal with entitlements without hurting, without adversely affecting the most vulnerable in America. But it also, at the same time, making sure that Social Security and Medicare, the two biggest of our entitlements, are sustainable over the long term. In addition, we need, in the fourth item we need to deal with, our tax preference items. We are a society now that is spending at the rate of 24% of our gross domestic product and levying taxes at the rate of 15.8% of our gross domestic product. No one needs to be above a second or third grade mathematician to know that if you're spending at 24% of what you have, and you're raising 15.8% of what you have to pay for it, that there's going to be a substantial difference. So that my recommendation and Democrats' recommendation is that we deal with everything on the that is subject to our expenditures and get a handle on them so that we can, in fact, balance the budget. That's the only way you're going to do it, and you will not do it in the short term. Unfortunately, I've been in Congress, I think this, hopefully my constituents don't think this is unfortunate. I've been in Congress for 30 years, and we have pursued a economic policy for many of those years with which I very substantially disagree. It's called supply-side economics. The theory behind supply-side economics is if you do less, you get more. Nothing in my life has instructed me that if I did less, I got more. I tried that in school for a little bit, and it didn't work. I haven't tried that on the job, but I know it won't work. We need to pay for what we buy. What the Republicans did, in my view, under Reagan, was to take the discipline out of the system. If I can buy things that all of us like and say that none of us have to pay for them, but the kids will pay for them, we'll all say, isn't that wonderful? It's not wonderful. And if we think about it more deeply, we will know it's not wonderful. So the answer to the question is, everything that we spend money on has to be on the table. We have to cinch our belts, all of us, in every sector, cinch our belts so that our children will not be confronted with the inability to respond to their international security issue, to their health issue, to their natural resource, natural disaster, that they will have resources because we will have husbanded the resources of our nation in a responsible manner.
We've heard that President Obama is going to involve himself in the budget discussions. Your thoughts on his involvement? I believe the meeting's today is first one.
His meeting today is. I, matter of fact, talked to Harry Reid early this morning. He was going in to meet with the president. My understanding, the Senate Republicans will be meeting with him a little later today. I know he's also talked to Mr. Boehner, and I talked to Mr. Boehner over the weekend. First of all, let me say, there, notwithstanding the fact that 75% of the American people respond that we should not increase the national debt, frankly, there is no alternative, responsible alternative, other than to increase the national debt. I try to give this very simplistic example to people. You have Macy's out here, don't you? You go to Macy's, use your credit card, and you buy $200 worth of goods from Macy's. You take them home, you use them, you sit down at the table with your husband or your wife or family and say, you know, we've really gone too deeply in debt. We're going to have a debt limit of $100. Macy's then sends you a bill and say, you owe us $200, and you write them back, sorry, we have a debt limit of $100. They write you a letter back, sorry, you have no longer any credit, and by the way, we're suing you. Extending the debt limit is for what we have bought, what we owe. And in that sense, Americans know as a American value, defaulting is not an American value, defaulting on your debts. We must increase the national debt. Mr. Boehner knows that. Mr. Cantor knows that. Mr. McConnell knows that. Every Republican, for the most part, knows that. There are a few who don't. Every Democrat knows that. And very frankly, in my view, if every American really thought about it, they would think, yes, America needs to pay its bills. If we didn't pay our bills, our economy would tank and the world's economy would tank. So that's not an option. So we need to extend the debt. Now, we need to get to a formulation where we can get the requisite number of votes to pass a debt limit extension. Now, even without the debt limit, we need to bring down our debt and deficit. Our deficits are annual operating deficit, and our debt is the accumulated annual deficits. So that hopefully we can come to agreement, and we're going to have to do so courageously because it will be controversial, just as TARP was. And we need to have a significant number of Republicans and a significant number of Democrats to do things that neither one of them will like wholly, but that we'll see as a compromise which is at least reasonable and acceptable. Nobody will like the final deal totally. If America is going to be the stable, responsible country we want it to be. So that I am hopeful that the president, and this was the question, the president and others, you're so kind not flipping those very fast, the president and Republican leaders and Democratic leaders will come together and make a proposal. I've talked to Mr. Boehner and said that if it is a reasonable proposal, if it does not impose draconian cuts that I think hurt very badly the most vulnerable in our society and our ability to grow our economy, because if we don't grow our economy, we're not going to balance the deficit. We're not going to balance, all right? We won't bring down the debt. We must grow our economy. So I'm hopeful that they can reach an agreement which will allow us to come together, vote together, and pass something that makes sense together.
Okay, we'll shift now to job creation.
I'll try to be briefer. She's been so kind to me.
She has really been good. We're going to shift now to job creation, which is the major topic of your presentation today. First question I have is, American corporations are currently sitting on record profits, and many are not paying any income taxes while investing overseas, not here. What can be done to get big business to create jobs here and invest in America?
First of all, let me tell you a little story. How many of you saw the 60 Minutes presentation where GE didn't pay any taxes and, in fact, got something back? You may have seen that. Shortly after that occurred, we had a leadership meeting. We came back that weekend. I think it was Tuesday afternoon. We had a leadership meeting. And everybody was angry about what GE had done. And about 5 minutes into that conversation, I said, hold on 1 second. I understand. I'm angry about it. We're all angry. But it didn't say that GE was breaking the law. GE was playing by our rules, the rules that the Congress had established. Remember I said my ideal tax policy would be do away with all preferences and bring rates down. That would be my perfect. It's not going to happen. But to the extent that we can get there, we'll be better off. Right now, for instance, on manufacturing, one of the reasons GE didn't pay any taxes is not because they didn't make money on the manufacturing side, but because they lost a lot of money on their finance side. You know, GE, the finance corporation side of their house. And they wrote off those losses against their earnings. That's one reason. There are other reasons as well. Very few people in America know what their effective tax rate is. I want you to think for just one second. I don't want you to raise your hand. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. That if you know what your effective tax rate is. Now, what I mean by that is you probably know, many of you are probably at 35% marginal rate. That's what you pay on your marginal income after deductions. But that's not your effective rate because you pay less than that. First of all, your first amount of money is taxed at a lesser sum. And secondly, your deductions take off something from your income. So if you made $100, you don't pay $35 in taxes. That would be 35% of that $100. I believe the president was absolutely correct when he made the observation that one of the reasons that we are having a problem competitively in the global marketplace is because our nominal rate is for corporations is one of the highest in the world. As a matter of fact, Japan is lowering its, and we may now be the highest nominal rate. That does not mean we have the highest rate of taxation for corporations in the world. It does mean, though, that psychologically the top rate is the highest. And a lot of us operate on psychology. You know, perception is reality, et cetera. You've heard that. So I think we need to bring down nominal rate to a lower number while broadening the base. That's what we did in 1986. You recall prior to 1986, some of us old enough to remember you could deduct your consumer credit. You can't do that now. We eliminated some of the preference items. And it seemed to me that makes sense because otherwise you're simply reflecting what people's choices are as opposed to what dollars they make and have the ability to pay. So I am hopeful that we will get to a system of taxation for corporations which will encourage them to stay here, not to send jobs overseas, not to give preferences for sending jobs overseas. Another question that is a thorny one will be how we deal with offshore income. The Ways and Means Committee under Mr. Camp are going to be dealing with that. We're going to deal with that because there's a lot of money overseas that if countries repatriated, they made it overseas, if they brought it home, would be taxed at rates very significantly higher than they believe makes it worthwhile for them to bring it home. We live in a free country. Under those circumstances, they can do that. But the answer to the question is we need to adopt policy which would incentivize keeping jobs here, growing jobs here, making it in America, while at the same time encouraging corporations to bring dollars home.
Related, there's a lot of there are several questions relating to cheap foreign labor and our lack of competitiveness due to that. And yesterday's there was an article in the New York Times regarding the construction of the San Francisco Bay Bridge and $400 million in steel for that bridge was constructed in China and shipped here. The whole issue and the article went into detail about the cheap labor. I think it was $12 an hour and for the Chinese laborers and the difficulty for U.S. firms to compete. So any comments on that and what we can do possibly to fix that?
Pan Shuang Wang, who's a 55-year-old steel polisher, is the gentleman to which you referred. It just so happens that I read the New York Times and put that article out. $400 million dollars for the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, part of it, being built in China. Let me read you this paragraph. But executives and officials who have awarded the various Chinese contracts say their audits have convinced them of the project's engineering integrity, because, of course, our steel workers. And I want you to know that while there was a time that America could not compete in the making of steel, that time has passed. That time was in the 50s and 60s when our steel makers had really built up their abilities in the late 30s and 40s. But 20 years, 25, 30 years later, technology had moved on. And, of course, Japan, Korea, and others had built new plants because their plants, of course, had been destroyed during the course of the war. So technologically, they were ahead of us. Today, America makes the best steel in the world. And we make it at competitive prices in the world. Anyway, let me read this. Project engineering integrity. And they note with the full financial force of the Chinese government behind its infrastructure companies. Let me read that again. Because there's some, frankly, in Washington who believe that all government needs to do is just get out of the way. Well, the problem, I talked to Andy Liveris. I don't know whether you know that name. He's president and CEO of Dow Chemical. He's written a book. He wrote the book about 6 or 7 months after we adopted our agenda item that I've just talked to you about it. But his publisher suggests the name of the book. The name of his book is Make It in America. Andy Liveris and I spent about an hour talking about this. And he said, you know, these people who think the government just ought to get out of the way, the problem is we're competing with large enterprises all over the world who see government as their partner. This sentence. And they note with the full financial force of the Chinese government behind its infrastructure companies, the monumental scale of the work and the prices bid are hard for private industry elsewhere to beat. So our companies are competing against China's government as well as their companies. Now, we can't expect that to happen. That's why we need a partnership. That's why we need a constructive policy to have a positive Make It in America agenda so that we facilitate the ability of our companies to compete. Yes, they make $12 a day. That's the gentleman I mentioned to you, 55-year-old steel polisher. The fact of the matter is, Ford is bringing company jobs back. Whirlpool, even GE, is bringing jobs back. John Deere wants to stay here in Illinois. The fact of the matter is we can compete because there's another factor that's happening that's inevitable that happens, and that is salaries are going up in India and China. So that the salary is becoming less competitive, and the reason people are bringing jobs back to the United States is because they are finding that productivity and quality is higher. In addition, let me give you another reason why. Shipping costs are escalating very rapidly. It costs a lot of money to run a big tanker. And as gasoline prices have gone up, it's become more expensive to ship jobs back. So America is becoming more competitive if we will adopt policies which encourage investment, job creation, and making things in America, which is why we need to bring rates down, eliminate preferences, have a fair and effective tax structure, and policies which do not encourage shipping jobs overseas. Thank you so much.
Congressman, there's a number of questions about our education system, and you've commented on some of those issues already. But specifically, again, it's international competition and other governments, other countries like Germany, and have such a stronger educational system, particularly in vocational education. And what do you think can be done to improve in that area in the United States?
First of all, I believe that parents need to have higher expectation of their children. There are two, this is, I know, a generalization, and therefore it's wrong, right? So from the very start, I will admit to you this is limps, because it's a generalization. My wife, who died some 14 years ago, an extraordinary woman, knew she wanted to be a teacher from the second grade. From the age of seven on, she knew she wanted to be a teacher. She was an extraordinary teacher, and she created a full-service school for 3 and 4 year olds, pre-K, pre-Head Start children in our county. And she was the supervisor of early childhood education at 119 schools under her aegis. And after she died, Governor Glendening and I and Mark Shriver, Sergeant Shriver's son, who was in the state legislature at that point in time, created these full-service schools. There are now 25 Judith P. Hoyer Early Childhood Education and Child Care Centers in our state. Nobody calls them that, of course. There are 25 Judy Centers in our state. Expectations need to be high, and so many parents do have high expectations, but so many don't. But there are two groups in America in particular that you almost invariably know that their children are coming to school ready to learn. You know who they are. The children of Jewish parents and the children of Asian American parents. I don't mean that African American, or my father was born in Denmark, I'm a Danish American, other parents and a lot of parents don't have high expectations. I think all my kids have high expectations of their children's performance. But you get what I mean. The first thing we need to do is have a general psychology, like Make It in America, that one of the reasons you're going to make it in America, son or daughter, is because you're going to go to school and you're going to learn. I don't want you to blame the teacher. I don't want you to blame the principal. I don't want you to blame the school. You're going to learn. That does not mean that we don't need to demand the highest performance. How many of you read Waiting for Superman? Saw. Saw the movie. I hope you see that. If you haven't seen that movie, see the movie. Michelle Rhee made a tremendous effort in Washington, D.C. of demanding high performance. Now, she was controversial. Anytime you demand high performance, you become controversial. But in my opinion, we need to expect high performance of all of us. I said that in my speech to you. In terms of competing, we need to expect high performance. John Kennedy asked us to ask not what our country could do for us, but what we could do for our country. There are too many people in America asking what their country can do for them. If we continue to do that, we're not going to win this global competition in which we're involved. We need to make it in America by investing in education. It's very nice to have high expectations, but we also have to have well-trained teachers. I supported No Child Left Behind. It's controversial. But Bush's premise was that Ted Kennedy and George Miller and I and others agreed with, and we didn't put the resources behind it that we promised. But the high expectations and accountability. We invest, as Americans, huge sums of money in education. And we have the right to expect that investment to pay off in a good product. That is, a child who is ready to confront the competitive environment which he or she will find when they get out of our school system. We need to continue to invest in higher education. And by the way, let me say this. We need to make sure that when the best minds in the world come to America for the best universities in the world, that when they graduate, we look them in the eye and say, you can make it in America. Stay here. Be here. We want you here. We need to address comprehensive immigration policy. I know that's controversial, but America is a nation of immigrants. She lifts her light beside the golden door and asks the homeless tempest-tossed to come to her. But it wasn't the second rates that came to her. It was the people who had the guts, the energy, the enterprise to come to this country with nothing in their pockets and make something of themselves and make this country what it is. We need to do that. But we need to invest in our education, primary, secondary, higher education, and have high expectations of our teachers, principals, students, and our parents.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is U.S. Congressman and Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer, who is discussing how to create jobs in America, in addition to other pressing domestic and global issues. Congressman, closer now to California, California is widely recognized as one of the leaders in clean technology and energy and working to combat climate change. What are you doing to push this vital issue on a national scale?
Well, I will tell you that one of California's favorite daughters has this as a principal item on her agenda, clean energy, green energy. We greened the Capitol. They're backing up somewhat now in the Capitol, unfortunately. We had biodegradable cups and spoons, and they've now gone back to styrofoam. Go figure. But in any event, one of the great opportunities we have in America is to focus on the development of green technologies, whether it's electric, whether it's water, whether it's wind, geothermal. We need to invest in building our industries that will be focused on greening America and greening the globe, because the globe needs it, and America needs it. And the globe understands that. There's some in our country don't understand it, but for the most part, even most Americans, not even, most Americans get it. But unfortunately, for instance, solar panels are now, we are at risk of having the Chinese make all our solar panels invented here in America. That's not good for us. So what do we do? In the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, we invested substantial sums of money in green economies. And what happened? We now see the growth of green enterprises in California and throughout the country. So we need to continue to invest in that. But let me say something to you. We need to invest in an energy policy which accomplishes energy independence. I don't mean that we won't use energy from outside. We will. Well, all countries do that. What I mean is that we will essentially have a sustainable energy supply here in this country. And we need to look at all sources of energy. Now, perhaps my great-grandson I told you about that's 5 weeks old, perhaps he will not be using, I hope he will not be relying on fossil fuels. But I don't expect in my lifetime, and I'm 72 years of age, I don't expect in my lifetime not to be using fossil fuels significantly. We want to use them cleaner and more efficiently and more effectively. Conservation is one of the big things that we need to focus on, but we need to focus on investment in green technologies.
This is an easy question. It's regarding healthcare costs.
I'll give an easy answer.
What major changes need to be made to take the cost of healthcare out of business cost?
Well, I don't out of business cost. Clearly, the delivery of healthcare is in fact a business in many respects. You've got a product or a service that you need to deliver, and you need to pay for it. To that extent, you need to charge a sufficient amount of dollars to make sure that service and hardware technology is available. Healthcare costs have gone up in some respects for three very good reasons, all of which we applaud. We're living longer. I just told you I'm 72 years of age. If you told me I could feel and look this way at 72 when I was 18, I would tell you you were crazy. I thought I'd have at least one foot in the grave. We're living longer. I have a life expectancy now well into the 80s. Many of you as well. The fact is that's good. some people think it's good. I happen to think it's good myself. Secondly, we have some extraordinary tools to find out what's wrong with us. The diagnostic tools available today in our generation tell us 80 to 90 to 95% more than we could have found out what was wrong with us 30 years ago. You can go into a doctor's office and with your wife or your husband, and the doctor can say, look, we'll do an X-ray. It'll cost you $150, and we'll probably find out 10 or 15% of that which we need to know about why your husband or wife is hurting. On the other hand, we can do a CAT scan or an MRI. It'll cost you 10 times as much, $1,500, but we might find out 95%. How many are going to choose the X-ray? Raise your hand. None of us are going to choose the X-ray. So that's another good reason. Third reason is when we adopted Medicare, prescription drugs were not a major portion of practicing medicine. Now they are. I had a cholesterol of 265 about 15 years ago. My last physical, I had a cholesterol of 165. The good stuff was where it ought to be, and the bad stuff was down. I take a Lipitor every night, and I eat cholesterol the rest of the 24-hour period. I tell people there's no way they can fix cholesterol. I don't like it. But prescription drugs. Okay, now what are we doing? We passed an Affordable Care Act, which I believe has the possibility of bringing down cost beyond that which were estimated by the Congressional Budget Office, which estimates we'll save $250 million in the next 8 years. And in the second 10 years of the Affordable Care Act, we will save over $1 trillion. Nobody knows whether that's the case. That's an awful long time to make a projection. But if we do that, that will be a substantial savings, and we need to do more. Now, healthcare costs of government are driven by healthcare costs generally, because government spends about 50 cents of every healthcare dollar that's spent in America, and we spend about $2.5 trillion on healthcare in America, and we spend more money per capita than any other nation on earth, and we spend it without as good an effect. Now, there are all sorts of reasons for that. First of all, our coterie. Is a very broad coterie, and we have a very broad spectrum of wealth in America. And as you can imagine, those of us who are wealthier have better health outcomes, and those who are not. That's why access to affordable quality health care is so important to saving money. Chronic disease costs us a lot of money to the extent we can get a handle on that. And in America, we have a health care system that has historically paid for volume, not value. Paid by procedures, not by outcomes. As a result, we have adopted in the Affordable Care Act a number of things and studies that will try to get us to dealing with outcomes rather than inputs. If you pay by inputs, what are you going to have? A lot of inputs. If you pay by outcomes, healthy people, it's a lot more efficient and effective. That's what our Affordable Care Act tried to do. Is it perfect? Of course it's not. It was adopted in one of the worst processes I've seen. Why? Because the Senate Republicans, very frankly, not because I'm serving this from a partisan standpoint, would not give 60 votes to go to conference. How do you make a bill better? You pass a bill through the House, you pass a bill through the Senate, you then go to conference, and you work on it and try to take the best of both. Unfortunately, the Senate Republicans, because they were against the health care bill, would not give the 60 votes in the Senate to go to conference. As a result, we adopted the Senate bill as it was. It was the only way we could do it, and did a reconciliation bill, which is very limited, and the Senate adopted that. But there is still much that remains to be done. But, ladies and gentlemen, that is a principal challenge for our society to come to grips with, and we need to do so in a way that is not demagogic, in a way that does not put on the internet, they're going to adopt death panels, which was an absolute fraud and bogus representation, but it undermined intellectual discussion of what, in fact, we were doing. This is a tough issue. It's one-sixth of our entire economy. It is essential for all of us, and we've got to get it right. Other countries have done so. We need to do so as well. That it?
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, let me say that I hope you've enjoyed being here as much as I have. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to U.S. Congressman and Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Jack Cordes, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.